right. Hello. My name is Chani, and I'm going to start with a song just to start the evening off. And thanks for everybody for being here. Thanks to everyone. This is a song called Birth of a Child that I wrote after the birth of my first child. And looking on what seemed to be at that time in 2008 sort of the biggest barrier, one of the biggest barriers to helping our planet and helping all of us, and still is greed and how we fight that to help combat climate change. Life goes on with the birth of a child. The sun comes rising when the darkness goes tired. I've been packing away, wondering what to do. I've been checking the tide since I gave birth to you. We want change, and we'll make it on our own. Burn down the hog towns, clean the water, feed the people, bury the light. What a disappointment the change has been. I thought we could hope away the big businessmen, but the lobbyists, they rule for the corporation's mule. I thought I'm opposed to it, but I'm part of it too. We want change, and we'll make it on our own. Burn down the hog towns, clean the water, feed the people, bury the light. We want change, 'cause we want change, 'cause we want change. Every step of the way, we gotta fight for our lives. Every step of the way, we gotta fight for our lives.
Thank you, Chani. Thank you very much. Well, good evening. Thanks for coming here to the UBS Forum. I'm Tom Cran from Minnesota Public Radio News from downstairs. I want to welcome you. It's a pleasure to be here, and I want to introduce Paul Huttner, the man who almost needs no introduction, but we're going to give him one, because he's been our chief meteorologist since 2007. That's 11 years of being on our air every morning on Morning Edition and every evening on All Things Considered. And on the air, he's a delightful companion. We've grown we have a friendship that transcends our on-air relationship, but What I admire most about Paul is his ability to take complex weather issues and sort of boil them down in ways that we understand, because he follows the science. So when it comes to the weather, he follows the complex science, and he does the same thing when it comes to climate, too, on ClimateCast. He looks at and follows the science and then sees where that leads us. And he looks for solutions, too. That's what we're going to be doing here tonight with our climate heroes. So it's a pleasure to have you here tonight for this live version of ClimateCast. Paul Huttner recently spoke at a group, the Midwestern Journalist Conference, and he was there at the invitation of the veteran broadcaster, anchor from WCCO, and one of Paul's former colleagues, Don Shelby. And I'm sure you're going to agree when you hear what Don Shelby said about Paul's work on ClimateCast here at Minnesota Public Radio. He called it courageous, and I definitely agree with that in this immediate environment that we have. I'm proud to say I work with Minnesota Public Radio News and work alongside Paul and bring ClimateCast to the air. So thank you for coming. We want to thank the McKnight Foundation. We want to thank Thomson Reuters, Bank of America for their generous support for ClimateCast. And of course, all the members of Minnesota Public Radio, you're all members. So thank you very much and enjoy the evening. Without any further ado, Mr. Paul Huttner.
Well done, sir. Thank you. Thank you so much. Good to see you. Hello. Thank you so much for coming and welcome everybody to ClimateCast Live, I guess we call this. This is different. This feels a little more like Oprah does ClimateCast. You get a hybrid. You get a hybrid. You're all getting solar at the end of this show. No, thanks again for coming out. We will be recording tonight for radio, so what you say can and will be used against you later on the radio. I was doing the math this week, and I can't believe it's been 5 years since ClimateCast started and has been on the air. That's kind of an interesting milestone for us. In 2013, I made a pitch to the folks here at Minnesota Public Radio that, you know, hey, there's a lot of climate science, a lot of climate news, a lot of emerging solutions going on every week. We should really do a weekly show on climate. And thankfully, they said, yeah, Paul, great. That sounds like a good idea. So here we are 5 years later, and I'm grateful to NPR for covering this important and emerging topic, because there aren't a lot of other local radio and TV stations that are doing that. And I think you can make the case that as I've been watching this for the last 5 years or so, it seems like what was once our climate theory is now becoming our weekly weather reality. We're seeing sort of a quickening of these extreme weather events, of the catastrophic damages, the catastrophic loss, the billion-dollar weather disasters. And that's unnerving, and it also, the scientists are increasingly drawing links between that and climate change. And I think when you get the world's second biggest reinsurance company, Munich Re, to write up a report on last year and comment on that, and I quote, "Natural disasters in 2017 were a sign of things to come. New coverage concepts are needed." That should get our attention. That got my attention, and it's getting the attention of a lot of companies, too. So tonight, what I thought, this is an opportunity for us to take stock. Where are we right now with Earth's climate today? What are the most important trends that we're seeing in climate and climate science? And maybe more importantly, where are we with solutions? That's a kind of an important concept these days. Climate change, to me and to many of you maybe, can seem like this massive problem, right? It's overwhelming some days. It feels like the scary monster under the bed that we don't always talk about. But I also see room for optimism. We're seeing a lot of good, productive things happening. And, you know, with these climate problems comes climate solutions and comes climate opportunities. And I think we're seeing more of those emerging with time as well. So we've got a great show for you tonight. Let's get started. I'm happy to introduce another guy that needs no introduction. He literally wrote the book on Minnesota climate. Please give a warm ClimateCast welcome to retired U of M professor and Minnesota climate guru, Dr. Mark Seeley. Thank you. Thank you. Well, good to see you right here, I think.
So, Mark, thank you, first of all. It's a pleasure to see you.
Pleasure to see you too, Paul.
I'm curious, when did climate change for you in your work become something that was on your radar? When did you really realize that Earth's climate was changing and we were part of that?
The big change for me personally came in May of 1991.
I've been here since the 70s, and I've been one of the caretakers of the Minnesota State Climate Database, which we're blessed with, that goes, as you know, back to the 19th century.
Yes.
And in my task as, or my duties as extension climatologist and teacher and researcher for the University of Minnesota, we would dovetail each week. We would connect with the observer networks in the state. We'd file state reports for all the state agencies. So we were literally looking at the data every week. And all of a sudden, in 1991, we saw a change where we were looking at numbers that we had not seen before. And that gets your attention.
Sure.
You know, if you see some measurement of whether it be temperature or rainfall or what have you, that is totally out of the population historically, it gets your attention.
Well, and you guys are statistics geeks, right? So you look at that.
That's exactly right. And I wasn't the only one. Mm-hmm. The wake-up call hit many of us in 1991. And from then on, it's just become even more amplified, you know?
Is that unique to Minnesota? I'm curious about your peers, like state climatologists around the country. Have they really perceived those same things in their data set, and are they using that information in their work?
I think it varies around our country because climate change is not uniform. There's disparity in the signal change. And so in some states, like the northern states, like Minnesota, North Dakota, Wisconsin, and if we also include our neighbors to the north, like Manitoba and Ontario, The signal change is amazingly amplified. It's bigger, if you will, than what you see in some other states. We've all heard about how huge it is in Alaska. And so the state climatologists that are caretakers of those states' data, they obviously give more attention where they see the numbers are changing quite significantly. Mm-hmm. There are states where the numbers aren't changing as magnificently as we've measured in Minnesota.
And that generally tends to skew south as you go.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Let's talk about where we are right now with Earth's climate, with Minnesota's climate. I see you brought some graphics, and this is radio, so I'll do my best to be descriptive with these
You bet. You bet.
As educators,
we like to equip Minnesota citizens with some fact-based knowledge. And so if we look at, for example, this depiction of the mean annual temperature trends in Minnesota, it justifies that, in fact, in our lifetime, and in fact, even for us old guys, our more recent lifetime,
right,
we've been going through a string of extraordinarily warm years in a historical sense. In fact, a population of warm years that's unprecedented as we look back in the instrumental record.
And this is data. This is not a model.
This isn't a model.
This is actually measured.
This is just what we've measured. It's not what we've measured at a single location, by the way. Mm. It's the pool data from the state database.
So even the rural stations are warming. People talk about the urban heat island.
No. We've got the classic, almost pristine data sets that are in unchanged landscapes in Minnesota, like out on the Op Jordan Farm in Chippewa County, mm-hmm. that have changed hugely over the years. And basically, there's no urban effect there. There's no damming of a river effect. There's no taking out a forest effect. It's just the same environment. And here we also see magnificent change in our moisture, our precipitation pattern. Again, we have lived through some of the wettest years in state history by our measurement records.
And Minnesota is getting wetter in general. Is that true?
It's getting much wetter. In fact, we represent an area of the country. Now, I'll show you the change temporally here, which is really striking. This is from a slide set that Kenny Blumenfeld, the senior climatologist of the state climatology mm-hmm. office, put together. For statisticians who are here tonight, this is a scatter plot. Okay, it's a two-variable scatter plot.
A bunch of dots all over the map.
The dots all represent individual years from 1895 to the present. So each dot is a composite depiction of what the mean temperature and the total precipitation for the year was. And what I want the audience to pay attention to and you to pay attention to is the upper right-hand quadrant of that diagram, which would be the warm, wet years. Now look at if we color code the population of these years since 1987.
Mm-hmm. I see a lot of red in the upper right
corner. You're absolutely right. We've been experiencing a pronounced distribution towards warm and wet over the last three decades. This is measured data. This isn't pretend anything. This is actually what we're measuring across the Minnesota landscape. The other thing is, as we consider our obligations as Minnesota citizens, our concerns as Minnesota citizens, it is absolutely right. I think we can make a valid argument. Which of the 50 states should have climate cast on twice a week? Probably Minnesota, because the color-coded diagram here shows that Minnesota is experiencing some of the most amplified warming of all the 50 states. That's what the red color depicts here. We've had some huge, huge changes in that parameter, and similarly, some huge, huge changes in the moisture, the precipitation, the green coded on this map. So if we consider ourselves in the whole context of our country and our fellow citizens around the country, we occupy a geography in the American landscape that is seeing some of the most pronounced change in temperature and precipitation.
And our biggies in Minnesota are the winters are getting remarkably warmer, correct?
Absolutely.
And we're getting heavier rainfall events.
Heavier rainfall amounts. We're getting... In fact, this study done by the American Association of State Climatologists a few years ago looked at mega rainfall events. I'm sure some people here have heard us speak about this on the radio. A 6-inch rainfall that encompasses 1,000 square miles with a central core value of 8 inches. These are rare events,
right,
state by state.
Yes.
In the first 140 years of our state history, we documented 7 of these.
Okay, 7 in 140 years.
But since 2002, we've documented 7 more.
Wow.
So this is a disturbing trend. And one other piece of this data that is startling is this level of convective thunderstorm has no preferred geography. As you can see from the map depictions here, they've occurred all over the state, from Lake of the Woods up on the Canadian border all the way down to southeastern Minnesota, east central Minnesota, all over the place.
Well, and some of the research that you've seen, I know, Mark, is that when we add 4 or 5% more water vapor to this warmer atmosphere, we're adding more energy to these storms, and they can increase rainfall maybe 10, 20, 30% in some cases.
Exactly. The column content of water vapor over Minnesota that could potentially, if the trigger were pulled, precipitate out. All the record values, or the lion's share of the record values, have been measured since 1991, that transition year I told you about in my career. Since 1991, almost all of our record values of water measured in the atmosphere over Minnesota have occurred.
Amazing. Column content, that's your takeaway for the evening.
There you go.
Listen, Mark, when people ask you about climate change in general, they know you're a climate guy. What's your biggest message to them?
It's real. It's happening. It's having significant consequences. More pertinently, it's having significant consequences to things we care about. Our natural resources, we need to look at the way we manage those, and our infrastructure, our fresh water supply, electric utility grid, transportation system, public health, etc. Something we should all care about. The knowledge-based data here that's coming from climate science should be used to cope with this issue. And at the local level, the state level, and the national level, we've been trying to make the argument, let's use our evolving knowledge on this so that we make better decisions about both adaptation and mitigation. And that's an argument I'm going to continue to make to the end of my life, as long as I have active gray cells. You know, once an educator, always an educator.
And we are so lucky to have you as an educator. I want to just personally thank you, too, for the many decades of service that you've given to Minnesota, the climate community. You've taught me and a whole lot of us a whole lot, and we thank you for that very much.
Well, I'm grateful for that. Thanks a lot, Paul.
Mark Seeley, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you.
Mark will be back a little bit later on in the show, too, so with the rest of our guests. Before we get to our next guest, I want to introduce you to a few key people that make ClimateCast happen every week. Kate Moose is the Director of News Content Development at American Public Media. She's the one who coordinates the big picture on ClimateCast. Kate, can you wave and say hi? Stand up. Thank you. Jane Solinger is the senior producer for ClimateCast. She makes us sound good on the radio every week, way smarter than we are. Thank you, Jane. You're the best. And is Cody here? Cody Nelson, the digital producer for ClimateCast. Cody, can you wave? He's up behind everybody. Hey, Cody. I also want to acknowledge NPR environment reporter Elizabeth Dunbar. She's done a great job reporting on climate stories over the last few years here at Minnesota Public Radio. And tonight, Elizabeth will introduce us to some very special young guests. Hi, Elizabeth. There you are.
So I get the pleasure of introducing all of you to the future. And here joining me first tonight is Lucas Reddy. You are a senior at St. Louis Park High School?
Yeah, I'm a senior.
Okay, and you are part of a group called I Matter. Tell everybody what I Matter is.
So, can I take this?
No.
Okay. So essentially, I Matter is a youth-led organization that helps empower young people around the whole nation, specifically in high school, to take city action, city policy, creating city policy, improving on city policy regarding climate change.
So you can tell he's an activist because he wanted to just grab that microphone, right? So, Lucas, tell us about what your group did with the city of St. Louis Park, and what does St. Louis Park have now that distinguishes it among cities?
Yeah, so my group, our environmental club at the high school, a couple years ago started this campaign. We went to city council, asked them to create a climate action plan, basically asking them to create a plan to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in St. Louis Park with specific strategies and goals along the way, et cetera. And we're here 2 years later, and in February, the city of St. Louis Park actually adopted the climate action plan that had been written, and it is now the most aggressive climate action plan in all of Minnesota.
And one thing, this is actually the third time that I have interviewed Lucas, because I covered this whole thing, and one of the things that was really interesting about this group and what they were doing is, first, they had these city councils pass what's known as a climate inheritance resolution. So what does this idea of climate inheritance mean?
Yeah, basically, we're here telling the city council, the people in charge of our city, we're here telling them that we're the moral authority and it's our future that they're making decisions for. And they listened to that. And actually, Mayor Spano said, our St. Louis Park mayor said exactly that. The decisions that their city council makes, it's not for them, it's for future generations. And that's really what made it so powerful when we came and told them, you know, we want this to be the change. We want this to be our change because it's our future. And they listened, yeah.
Lucas and I were both here early to make sure we were all in place. And he gave about, I don't know, maybe 10 different hugs through the course of people coming in and out. What are you doing these days?
Yeah, so I work for I Matter. I work as a program facilitator, and St. Louis Park was kind of the kickoff city with this campaign that I Matter had, and it was so successful. I mean, in 2 years we created this climate action plan that no other city had created, and it was completely youth-led. The ask, the creation, and the implementation of it so far. And we're like, okay, this is going to be big. And we have started implementing it in other cities around Minnesota. You'll hear from them later on as well, and across the nation as well. So I've been connecting with individuals, with groups around Minnesota. Actually, they come to us because they hear about us. We have had to make nearly no outreach because of the change that we've done and the attention that we've gotten. I mean, you said you've interviewed me 3 times, right? And now I basically show them the program and adapt the program to whatever their city needs. And we've essentially been changing what's politically possible because we've created such a strong cohort of young people trying to achieve the same thing. Yeah.
And that is Lucas Reddy from St. Louis Park High School. We'll come back with a few more, Paul.
Thank you. Elizabeth, thank you. Lucas, you're an impressive young man. Thanks so much. So I want to shift gears a little bit now and talk about something that a lot of people don't think about with climate, but it's really important, and that's water. It is Water Month here at Minnesota Public Radio, and Radhika Fox is here with us. She's with the U.S. Water Alliance, a national nonprofit organization that brings together water providers, public officials, business leaders, and others to build a sustainable water future for all of us. The Alliance also coordinates the Value of Water campaign, dedicated to raising awareness about the nation's aging water infrastructure. Please welcome Radhika Fox. So, first of all, thank you for coming. You came to us from California, is that right?
Thank you.
And no intense wildfires or floods or anything this week?
Not this week.
Thankfully. You know, there are so many ways, Radhika, that climate and water intersect. Let's just start with some of the big ones. What are the top two or three ways that climate and water are really ultimately tied together?
Well, before answering that, I want to start with, for us at the U.S. Water Alliance, we are really concerned that our nation's water future is really at risk. There have been all of these challenges that we face. I live in California, right, mm-hmm. where we have historic drought. Here in Minnesota, where you have plentiful water, but the water quality challenges are significant. Other communities have too much water and flooding. And this is all happening on water systems, water infrastructure that were built for 50, 100 years ago.
Right. I've said before, I like to say that we sort of have this 19th and 20th century infrastructure in a 21st century climate.
Absolutely.
Right? So it's just not built to handle the extremes.
And that's exactly what we're facing. So we have this tremendous challenge around how do we make these systems ready and prepared for Lucas and the next generation. And climate is adding additional stress and strain. So your question, how is water and climate related? Actually, the truth is that water is the way that people most intensely experience climate stress in their life. So if you think about flooding, that is the most common natural disaster that people face in California alone that has caused just $30 billion of impact on people. If you think about drought and the fact that precipitation levels have dropped by over 10% in the western states over the last two decades, wells are running dry. Literally, people do not have access to water in certain communities in the Central Valley. If you look at Louisiana, there's some of the islands in Louisiana have lost a landmass of 90% because of the rising sea levels. And so we have our first climate refugees in Louisiana.
And that's happening now.
It's happening now, today. Absolutely.
You touched on this a little bit in your answer. What about the equity of water and climate? It doesn't necessarily distribute itself equally to all social and economic groups, does it?
That's absolutely right. You know, if you look at the history of environmental stress generally in this country, race is one of the biggest predictors of the stress that people will face. And so we are very concerned at the U.S. Water Alliance that low-income people, communities of color, seniors, the elderly, the most vulnerable in our community, in our country, are being hit first and hit worst. I was just in Camden, actually, recently visiting with some of our member partners there. And Camden, it's a very poor city, as people know. The infrastructure, the water infrastructure is aging. So when it rains, there's extreme flooding in these neighborhoods. And, you know, we see children who are literally walking to school through sewage. And so the public health impacts of that, it's really not understood, but it's all connected. It's all interconnected. And that's why we need everyone to be part of the solution.
How do we make the links between climate and water and people's lives more real to people? How do we do that as communicators?
Right. I think conversations like we're having this evening, I think the fact that Minnesota Public Radio has a new effort called Water Main that is really trying to raise people's IQ and EQ, as they say, around water. You know, some of the work that we're doing at the U.S. Water Alliance is really working with artists, right? Because it's very hard for people to understand the oceans are going to rise 6.5 feet, you know, in the by the end of the century. What does that even mean to us, mm-hmm. right? So one of the things we've been doing is working with artists who really can help us understand these invisible systems. So, for example, there's an artist, Eve Mosher, who in 2007 walked 70 miles along the coast of New York, which is one of the most vulnerable cities to sea level rise.
Right.
And she talked to people about, you know, she would took blue chalk and walked and marked it. And people would ask, what are you doing? And so it became this way for her to have a conversation.
And those were the areas where the sea level would rise to on your street, for
yep.
example.
And so she did that in Tucson. And so it created a whole different conversation. And then, of course, when Supersand Sandy happened 5 years later, those areas were all just devastated by that rain and floods.
We know there are challenges, right, talking about climate and water. Are there opportunities?
Absolutely. I mean, we see opportunity every day. I mean, one of the things to know is that we really are at the dawn of the replacement era when it comes to our water systems. And, you know, the utilities here in the Twin Cities, they are investing, you know, billions of dollars in the next decade to shore up these systems. And so we have to do it with an eye towards climate resilience. We have to do it with an eye towards equity.
You know, we hear about conservation, right? I mean, the quickest way maybe to keep our water supply viable is to conserve it. We hear about places like Israel. We hear about places that are doing a good job. Who is doing water right around the world, and what can we learn from that?
This is why I love my job. I'm so full of optimism. You know, in San Francisco, where I live, we are the first city to actually incorporate sea level rise guidance into how we make choices about our capital projects. In Miami, there's an effort called Resilient Miami, where there are community ambassadors who are really talking with people about how to what's at stake for them and their families around climate change. There's just so much good work happening all around the country. I think the challenge is, how do we lift that up? How do we shape the policy conversation that is really absent, frankly, around climate in Washington, D.C., with these stories and solutions?
I feel like we're living in a weird time right now.
We are.
Because
very weird.
All this stuff is happening, right?
Yes.
The science says it's happening. The daily news shows it happening.
Right.
A lot of companies get it. They're starting these pretty significant efforts in climate sustainability. And yet, as you touched on, at least our politicians, many of them in this country, don't get it. What's your lay of the land here? What's our sense for optimism as we look forward?
Well, you know, one thing that makes me optimistic is the man that was sitting next to me at the bar last night, who I shared a tequila shot with, actually. He was...
careful.
Right? Oh, wait, we're on radio, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, but he was a seafood purveyor, and he said, what are you doing here in Minnesota? You're visiting from California. And I said, oh, this thing about climate change. And, you know, I thought that would sort of make him be like, oh, let me turn the other way. What is this with climate change?
Right.
But he said, absolutely, we experience climate change every day. He's like, the change in climate has made my job so much harder because, you know, we used to be able to predict where the fish would be and where we would fish. But with the rising temperatures, the migration patterns are way more inconsistent. So I am optimistic that our politicians may not get it, but the public does. And so we have to have a sustained education and awareness campaign. You know, we're actually, this is a major midterm election. We have 36 governor races that are up in November, countless mayoral races around the country, state houses are at play. And so as voters, as residents, we need to be asking our politicians, what will you do for water? What is your agenda around these more, and you don't even need to call it climate change, around these much more extreme and unpredictable weather events. And I think we have to force that conversation in a more aggressive way, frankly.
Great perspective. Thank you. Retica Fox. Thanks. With the U.S. Water Alliance. Thank you. By the way, if you want to follow along on Twitter or submit any questions, the hashtag is ClimateCastLive, so feel free to do that. You're listening to ClimateCast Live on NPR News. I'm your host, Paul Huttner. Let's go back to Elizabeth Dunbar and hear from some more of our iMatters folks. Hi, Elizabeth.
Yes. Hello, Paul. We've got... tell us your name and where you go to school.
Okay. My name is Sophia Trumpy, and I go to Eden Prairie High School. I'm a senior.
And we have Antonio.
Hi, my name is Antonio Montero. I go to Eden Prairie High School. I'm also a senior.
All right. So I'm going to start with Antonio. When did you start thinking about climate change and thinking, hey, you know, I think I want to get involved in this thing?
Yeah. Well, growing up, you always hear about climate change, global warming, but that kind of just goes as an afterthought. But I think around 9th, 10th grade, as I started developing my political views, my partisan views, you start learning more, reading media outlets, news articles regarding the facts and statistics that climate change has given us, and you start to see the inaction that politicians have done. And I don't know, I just wanted to see more action in Congress, and seeing as the Paris Climate Agreement, seeing that, I was ecstatic to see that, and then to see the trend that we have now moving away towards the Paris Climate Agreement. The EPA is kind of not in the best of places as of now. So that kind of brought me to Sophia and the Environmentalist Club at Eden Prairie to start taking more aggressive action against climate change.
So this group at Eden Prairie High School started to engage their city. And one of the things that they do through iMatter is it's kind of like a report card like you get in school. So can you tell us a little bit more about what that report card looks at?
Yeah, so like she said, the report card is exactly like a report card you'd get at school, and there's a few different categories. The first one is, does your city have a climate action plan? And if so, is it good? And then a few other categories include renewable energy, how is the city doing on waste, carbon removal, and does the city have youth involved? Like, for example, do they have 2 youth seats on the Conservation Commission?
And why is that important?
That's important because it's our future, and so we should have a say in it.
Okay, and what did Eden Prairie get as a grade?
Prairie got a C.
A C, and then how did your city council react to that? Were they like, no, we're doing fine, or what did they say?
Yeah, well Eden Prairie is pretty, we're kind of cocky. Like, I mean, we were like voted number one place to live or something in the United States, so they were pretty sad about it, but... Yeah, I think they asked during our presentation, like, are you sure, or something like that. But but it's actually, like, an average score for most of the cities around here. St. Louis Park got a B-, but, like, Edina got a C+. We got a C. Yeah, they weren't happy about it, but that's making them kind of competitive and wanting to improve the grade, which is good.
This is our future, Paul.
It is, and, you know, thank you so much for that. And if Eden Prairie would just stop winning all the high school sports championships, I'd be all right with that. Great work, Antonio and Sophia. Thank you so much. You know, we got this little thing over here called the University of Minnesota, not too far away, and they're doing some really great work over there on climate and environment. This is Jessica Hellman. She's the director of the Institute on the Environment at the U of M. She is a biologist whose research focuses on global change ecology and climate adaptation. She's argued that adaptation, living with climate change, is just as crucial to our collective future as stopping greenhouse gas emissions. Please welcome Jessica Hellman.
Hello.
So thank you for coming and doing this.
Thank you for having me.
Give me the elevator speech. What's the U of M Institute on the Environment do?
Oh, it's a wonderful place. So the Institute was created to aggregate across a massive university like the University of Minnesota. There are environmental scholars in every field and discipline, and we have to have ways to come together and work collaboratively, because these real-world problems like climate change need us to work across these fields. So our job is to aggregate those scholars and then put them to work on real-world problems like food and ag and land sustainability and biodiversity and climate change. And we usually work with people outside the university, and we're very oriented on tangible solutions.
Great elevator speech. I think that was about 8 floors. That was perfect. So where are we, do you think, when it comes to climate change? Are the building blocks there for us as humans to do a better job of prospering with nature?
Yeah, actually, I was talking to a group of students about this recently, that, you know, why would you want to study environmental science? you know, are all the important questions answered? And it's an interesting sort of duality that on the one hand, the evidence and the knowledge that we have is so profound and quite clear that humanity has a strong influence on our environment, on all aspects of our environment, including our climate. On the other hand, there are still so many interesting questions and things to study, which is one of the reasons why I'm especially interested in this idea of adaptation, because we must address climate change, we must stop emitting greenhouse gases if we have any hope of adapting to the climate change we've already caused. But how we're going to do that really remains mostly unknown.
So that is kind of the big question. How are we going to do that? How do we as humans start to adapt?
Yeah, and it's kind of, I like to say the adaptation is also the gateway drug to mitigation. That when you think about what, take a particular problem, like we were just discussing, Radhika was talking about water and stormwater runoff, or I tend to work on questions about natural resource conservation. So take a particular issue, something that's affected by climate change, and start unpacking that. What are the management strategies that are available to you? How could we go about addressing this? If it's larch beetle spreading across Minnesota and diminishing larch populations. Okay, well, those play an important role in bog ecosystems. How could we substitute those with a different species, for example? And then you start thinking about how difficult that might be and how expensive it might be. And so there are a lot of viable strategies. They're not going to be easy to implement, and there will be side effects. That's the other important thing. And once you add all those numbers up, it does kind of make wind power look pretty appealing as an alternative strategy.
How are we doing as scientists when it comes to communicating on climate? You know, I interview people all the time. There are rock stars out there,
yeah.
Rock star scientists. I mean, I can think of Michael Mann. I can think of Catherine Hayhoe, mm-hmm. among others, who just nail it. They do a great job. But as we know, scientists are a little introverted sometimes. How do we train scientists to be better communicators?
Yeah, I think even, there are some scientists that deserve to stand out front and talk to the public or are good ambassadors for us as a field, that's for sure.
Yes.
And I don't think we want to or need to put all of our environmental scientists and climate scientists in front of people. That's not the job of everyone to do. So I think we really should celebrate our science communicators and encourage them. But I also think it's worth admitting to ourselves as climate communicators, those of us who participate in it to a certain degree, that we have not always done a good job. I think we're getting better and we're getting smarter. It took a long time to realize that people actually care about people, not just about the climate. So how does the climate influence things that people care about? That's what we need to be talking about. I think we've gotten better about talking about really hard ideas that are hard to wrap your head around, like what is uncertainty? Mm-hmm. Scientists love to talk about uncertainty. No one has any idea what that really means. But it's about being clear about what we know and clear about what we don't know and the difference between the two. I think we've gotten more savvy about that. And now we teach, how do we teach climate scientists? It's actually easier in the sense that young people, and I can say this for students I interact with at the University of Minnesota, they actually want to be at that interface. Many, many people want to do science that is directly relevant to social problems, and they're eager to engage in that boundary between science and society. And I think that's, you know, some of our climate science community got into it because they could sit behind a computer and no one would bother them. But maybe our own culture is changing a little bit.
You know, I kind of get uncertainty, but I'm just not really sure about
exactly.
it.
Exactly. You're uncertain about
cheap.
Uncertainty.
So what about me? What about these people sitting a few feet away from us? What does the individual person do when it comes to adapting? Are there good resources for that? Where do you guide people?
There are. Well, some of our young students were just talking about climate action plans. Oftentimes, some of the decision-making about what should be done and the priorities for is being tackled at the municipal level, because a lot of the adaptation actions will need to be taken in infrastructure, and they involve a certain amount of planning. You need to say, what are we going to do in this decade? What are we going to do in the next decade? Because this is a changing process. This is not something we just say, oh, well, we'll implement what 2050 is going to be like. We have to have a process of updating and adjusting. So you see a lot of city leadership. There are resources out there. There are some really great resources coming out for forest management, for example. The U.S. Forest Service has some new work plans that invite foresters to actually sit down and say, what are you trying to accomplish? What are the natural resources that are at risk? What are the viable options for you? There's actually a silver lining in some adaptation work in that, especially in the natural resource space, we sometimes are managing resources without being very clear about what our goals are. Mm-hmm. And when the environment is changing and you have to manage differently, it causes you to actually be explicit about what we're trying to achieve. What are we managing this landscape for? And then to more clearly explain to the public what strategies are being used in order to achieve that management. So there are some actually great conversations that are happening around, say, natural resource management in the name of climate change, because it's bringing people together to tackle a new problem.
Interesting stuff. Jessica Hellman with the University of Minnesota, thank you so much for the perspective.
Thanks, Paul.
We heard from Chani before, and we have the honor of hearing from her again. She's the lead vocalist and co-songwriter, Chani Lena, with the electro-pop group Polisa. And this group formed in Minneapolis in 2011, has gone on to international acclaim. Her vocals, her melodies, as you've heard, are beautiful and have been featured on recordings by Boys Noize, Sasha, Lane 8, and Left Field, as well as with her Americana-leaning project, Roma Di Luna. Please give a warm welcome to Chani Lena.
Thank you. This is a Woody Guthrie song called Pastures of Plenty. It talks a lot about our world and plants and water. And it's a mighty hard road my poor hands have followed. Poor feet to travel that hard, dusty road. And out of your dust bowl, and westward we roll. Deserts was hot, and your mountains was cold. I worked in your orchards, beaches and prunes. Slept out on the ground of the light of your moon. On the edge of the city, you see us and then come with the dust and we go with the wind. North up to Oregon to gather your hops. Dig the beets from your ground, cut the grapes from your vine, sit on your table and light sparkling wine. Green pastures are plenty from dry desert ground, from the Grand Coulee Dam, where the waters run down. Every state in this union, us migrants have been, we'll work in this fight, and we'll fight till we win. Till we win.
Channy, can you come over and sit with us for a minute? Thank you so much. Beautiful, beautiful music. Thank you.
I never ever play the guitar, so it was a nice opportunity for
Well,
me
we wouldn't know that for sure. It's lovely. So you're pretty climate aware. We had a chance to talk in the back. Tell us about your road to climate awareness. How did it happen for you?
It really started to peak when I moved to North Minneapolis, grew up in Minneapolis. I love the lakes and rivers. I love the nature. It's one of my favorite parts about being in Minneapolis and living in Minnesota. And feeling the immediate effects of pollution and chemicals in the environment and how they affect more communities more so than others. And joining with other community members and neighbors in North Minneapolis and around the city to hold corporations accountable for their contribution to climate change, pollution, factories that sit on the Mississippi River that block my view and my neighbor's view from the river and our access to it. Became clear to me when I wanted to walk my children to the river. It's only about 5 blocks away. I had to cross through about 5 or 6 different toxic factories and get a headache just going trying to walk to the river. And that creates barriers for people to enjoy water and therefore like care about it and fight for it. The other thing was talking about adaptation and public health and, you know, if especially at a time like this when our government is denying the effects of climate change and the EPA is not does not have our backs at this time, how can we work together with our neighbors and our community to take care of each other, find ways to, you know, be activists against for climate change and improving the environment, but also how can we take care of our bodies when we're dealing with the effects of climate change and even our houses? If there's going to be more flooding, if there is going to be more pollution in the air, how can we protect our bodies and our children, you know, more air purifiers in the house and access to those sort of things that can help people survive climate change?
You're an artist. I assume you hang out with artists.
Is
climate change on artists' radar?
Well, a lot of us tour quite a bit. And so we see places, you know, we've seen places in Italy like that, you know, Vienna that are almost, you know, shutting down to tourists because they can't, it's flooded.
Yeah, Venice.
Venice, sorry.
Yeah, no, that's all right.
My bad there. So, but also we see a lot of communities around the world that are dealing with it and not denying it. And it's just a part of both conservative and left-leaning politicians, platforms. So we're seeing cities that are just dealing with it and they're moving forward. And so that's hopeful and exciting to see, but then you come back home and you're like, got to get onto it. So it's definitely something that we see. And then also just touring and the weather, and weather affects artists and musicians just like everybody else, because we have to travel so much and be on the road and visit cities. And you meet, was just in Cincinnati and it was such a beautiful city, but people there were all talking about how, you know, everywhere around them it's flooding constantly and they're just waiting for it to take over their city. So people are talking about it all over the country, and I find that when I meet people when I travel.
Tell us what you're doing these days with the band. Are you touring, writing? What's going on with your music?
We are doing, Polisa's doing some writing, and we'll be doing a benefit to Saturday, April 28th at Modest Brewing for a dear friend. And Roma de Luna is releasing a record on May 4th, and we have a release show at the Cedar, and both bands will be playing around this summer, and then Polisa will put out a record here eventually, and then we'll be on the road.
Thank you so much for playing
Thanks
for us
Thanks for
tonight.
Having me.
Thanks, Channy. Channy Lennon, everybody. Let's bring back Elizabeth to talk to some more amazing young people.
All right, we're back with the future. And I'm going to introduce you to Isra and Ethan, and they're going to tell us where they go to school and what grade you're in.
Hi, my name is Isra. I go to South High School in Minneapolis, and I'm a freshman.
My name is Ethan. I'm a senior at Southwest High School.
Tomorrow is a big day in the city of Minneapolis. What do we have going on in Minneapolis tomorrow?
Yes, absolutely. So the city is releasing their plan to get a resolution to have the city commit to running on 100% renewable electricity by the year 2030. And so this is a big deal for us because, unlike other kind of smaller cities, Minneapolis already has a climate action plan. And so when we were looking to get involved with iMatter, we talked with experts, and one of the biggest ways that we found that our city could cut down on our emissions would be to commit to running on renewable electricity. And so we came up with the goal of having 100% renewable electricity by 2025. And so at the same time, city officials were also working to get on a plan to have Minneapolis commit to the goal by 2030. And so we came to the great place where we were pushing them while industry people were trying to push them and saying, it's crazy, you can't do it, you have 2040 at the earliest. And so we heard from them that we were a really big part of this process, and we were grateful that it's now finally passing.
So Isra, what did you guys do to push the city on this?
Well, at first, we did contact several schools across Minneapolis and got them all involved. And then we started making meetings with city council members. And then we found out that we had to contact the chair of the environmental committee, Councilmember Cunningham. And so we made a meeting with him, and we were able to get on the actual agenda of the committee. And so we went and talked to them, and then they listened to us and agreed with us. So now we are talking to the full city council, actually, I'm pretty sure tomorrow, to hopefully make sure that this happens. So yeah, we're definitely working with a lot of other people to make these things happen as soon as possible.
Why is it so important to do it sooner? I mean, Ethan mentioned, you know, that there's groups that want to just delay it because they think it's too hard. I mean, why do we have to do this so fast?
Because we don't have a lot of time, actually, with the amount of like pollution and all the problems that are happening with our environment right now, we really do not have enough time. And 2040 is so far away from now. And if we can do it by 2030, then we can all, especially since we are so young, it makes our lives easier knowing that we'll have 100% renewable electricity by 2030. And so it just makes it better for the newer generation and probably save lives.
Okay, fun question here. What do you want to be when you grow up?
Wow.
He wasn't expecting that one.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. I'm not sure if I would go into something climate related, but at least kind of analyzing city policies and governmental policies. I think that's been a really cool part of this effort, is getting to learn how our public systems work and, you know, finding out what works and what doesn't. But honestly, at this point, I have no idea.
And Isra, you're just a freshman. Do you know what you want to do?
Yes, I do, actually. I'd like to be a lawyer and then eventually run for public office.
There you have it. That's our future, Paul.
Wow, that's awesome. Thank you so much. Thank you, Elizabeth. I want to welcome everybody back to ClimateCast Live. I'm meteorologist Paul Huttner, your humble weather host for the evening. Let's bring everybody back. Jessica Hellman, Radhika Fox, Mark Seeley, come on back. Let's have a little chat here. Welcome everybody back, please, if you would. So here's a softball, right? Right away, we'll just toss that out. I don't know who wants it, but is there enough discussion about solutions? One of the things that, you know, has been interesting to me to watch the trajectory of ClimateCast from when we came on the air 5 years ago is, first it was like, oh my God, there's this huge climate problem. Then it was like, okay, everybody gets, or at least more people get, that there is a big climate problem. And now it's like there's all these really cool solutions, and they're happening faster, some of them, than people projected. So what do you think? Do we talk enough about the solutions?
I'll just volunteer an observation in that regard. Last May, here at the River Center in downtown St. Paul, we were privileged for the first time to host the National Adaptation Forum. We had all 50 states represented there. We had over 1,200 attendees, and we heard from practitioners of adaptation, be it public works departments or city councils or transportation services, utility providers, public health officials, a whole gamut. And I think that this kind of a forum is deserving of more attention. This occurs about every other year. It's a national meeting. Mm-hmm. But it's through the sharing of our practical application of our knowledge and what works and what doesn't that we gain a lot from each other. And I wish, in some respects, that the national media had covered that national forum last May a little bit more than it did, because I think things like that, venues like that, are really very, very worthwhile.
I see, Paul, we do know on the mitigation front pretty much exactly what the solutions are. It's, in that sense, climate change is a really simple problem. It's really very simple, right? You have these greenhouse gases, we're adding them to the atmosphere. The concentration of them increasing is warming the planet. So first we have to stop adding them. So we have to reduce how much we add, and then eventually we have to add zero. So we can calculate exactly how much carbon we emit now and how much we must stop emitting in order to get to zero. And then you can back calculate how you're going to do that. How much of that is going to be wind? How much of it is going to be solar? And then the tricky part, so the solutions and the technological solutions mostly exist, right? I drove here today in an electric car that exists. You can buy it in the market. I have solar panels on my roof. The tricky part about the solutions is the deployment, it's the financing, it's making it accessible to all people, it's building political will for it. And then I think we also, on the adaptation side, we have a lot of solutions, but we can't quite do that same math where we figure out exactly the magnitude that we need and then calculate what the parts are to get it.
You know, at the U.S. Water Alliance, we say that the water challenges that our nation faces are tremendous, but our capacity for innovation is even greater. And we certainly see that with the communities we work with around the country. And I think that the solutions frame and focusing on solutions is so important, because really what we're asking people to do is really embrace complexity, right? It's doom and gloom if you look at the numbers around climate, and Mark and Jessica know those numbers well. And so how do you help people understand the urgency of the problem but not feel hopeless? And that's why we always pivot to what the solution is, and that everyone is part of the solution. That's what we do at the U.S. Water Alliance, right? Farmers are part of the solution. Young people are part of the solution, as we've been hearing this evening. Utilities, environmental groups. So to own that we are all part of that solution, and we have to work together to get there.
I want to talk about corporate America for a minute, because I got to tell you, that's in a lot of ways one of the places I see optimism. We have interviewed many, many corporate executives on ClimateCast over the last few years who are actually seeing climate change show up either in their supply chains or in their extreme weather disruptions or in their business models. And we're seeing a lot of companies begin to institute wide sustainability programs around climate. They're also getting demand, consumer demand, to be more climate friendly, more climate responsible. What have you guys observed there, and how do we reconcile that with what seems to be the glacial pace of government?
I have to say that with this last election cycle, I have been so impressed with parts of corporate America and how they have stood up and reaffirmed their commitment around climate, just as, for example, my governor, Governor Brown in California has. And it really is tremendous. And it's a both, I think, for a lot of these companies, for example, Dow based here in Edina, their water stewardship report, it is both bottom line business sense for them, because they recognize we are not making the chemicals and other things that we make if we don't have clean access to water, et cetera. So it's a bottom line business decision, but I think it's also sort of keeping an eye on the future, right? So I think as our current administration has backed down, I think we've seen a lot of corporate America step up, and we should be applauding them for that.
Yeah, they also, right, this is a global economy. So the American political system is, in essence, lagging the global economy. I think a lot of private industry sees innovation opportunities, emerging markets dealing with some of these challenges around the world, and is actually asking government to provide some parameters around which we can really develop our businesses. I think actually this is one of the unspoken sort of scary parts of a failure to recognize climate change and other global forces is actually potentially a market failure, in that other economies will beat us in that solutions and innovation space. And so, you know, we need to be cognizant of our of the economic opportunities that come with getting on board.
Yeah, and we're seeing that in China to a degree. They are really the world's leader now in solar production. And, you know, that is a huge economic opportunity. We talk about that too. Mark, I know, how do you reconcile that with, we've pulled out of the Paris Accords here. You know, it seems like our government has gone backwards and is even in some ways placing bets on fossil fuels, or trying to. There are obviously those lobbying forces. How do we move forward as Americans in that landscape?
Well, I think at the local level, community level in Minnesota, we have some shining examples. I've had the privilege of serving on the Climate Adaptation Partnership Awards Committee the last several years. We've had nominations come in from all over the state. One area or sector that I see particular attention being paid is in the renovation of decayed or old infrastructure and or the deployment of new infrastructure. In other words, facilities management and design. And there's tremendous efforts to look at sustainability practices, conservation practices. How do we conserve energy? How do we conserve water? How do we handle our waste better, et cetera, et cetera? And how do we deploy more renewables in the use of whatever the renovated or new structure is? There's been tremendous work being done, and there's lots of stories like that throughout Minnesota that I see coming up. And now these are at the community level. So I think that over time we're going to see more and more of this type of, it's almost like, what do we want to say, corporate role modeling. Mm-hmm. From smallest scale all the way up to the grand scales, the big companies like you've mentioned earlier. And I really see that as having a lot of momentum to it. And that's going to migrate upward in its political influence in our system of government here, I think.
I'm amazed at how quickly some of that mindset has shifted in the past 5 years or so. Radhika or Jessica, what do you think that landscape is now as we look forward the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, I'm not from Minnesota. I am a Midwesterner, but I've been here now a few years, and I am really drinking the Minnesota Kool-Aid. And that I think, with all due respect to California, that's doing amazing things, I actually think we have enormous opportunity for leadership. And so when I look 5 years ahead, I think there's going to be a lot of action in this state across sectors, ag, electricity. We got some really amazing leadership in the electric utilities. And so I think other states in our region and otherwise will be looking to Minnesota. We've got a better political environment and a willingness, at least in Minnesota, to say we're going to decide for ourselves what is appropriate. We're not going to necessarily fall into the national rhetoric. So that's my 5-year hope. About the action that we'll see in this state and the other people who will follow.
Radhika, what about you? What are you seeing?
Well, you know, I think if we look out 5, 10 years and you know, the future of America, it is going to be the choices we're making now around our water, climate, energy, all of these things. And, you know, what I hope we can all do together is really flip the script, right? Mm-hmm. That help people understand that our water systems are at risk, and that puts our nation at risk, that all of the impacts of climate, et cetera, but that actually offer a positive vision of how we can actually recover stronger and be more resilient, right? And how do we treat some of these very visible crises? You know, Puerto Rico, where 1 million people without water. What's happening in Houston right now, they're not just trying to rebuild to what they were, but having a vision around rebuilding stronger and better. So that's my hope for this nation around water and climate in the future.
What's one thing, Mark Seeley, that everybody in this room can do to either educate themselves or make a positive impact with regard to climate change?
I think I fall back on, it's kind of a classic Minnesota answer, but we all as individuals have spheres of influence. They exist within our family, our community, all the various professionally and personal communities that we interact with. And the very bottom line, the very minimum we can do is role model, live our lives in a way where we explicitly give attention to this and we pay attention to our carbon footprint, our water footprint, our waste footprint, et cetera, and that people around us see us living in that manner. That's an absolute minimum, but it's something that everybody can do.
Are you optimistic, Jessica, Radhika, as you look forward? What are you most hopeful about?
I think the thing I'm most hopeful about as a national organization, I am so lucky to be able to work with communities all around the country. And what excites me is how people are coming together. They are uniting. They're really trying to stretch beyond the differences that we see to find these common ground solutions around water security and climate security. And so it's really people that give me optimism and what's really, frankly, happening at the local level.
Jessica, how about you?
I'm hopeful about things becoming readily available in the marketplace. I think that a lot of the climate solutions that we talk about and the ways it's a little bit easier to answer what you can do question now than it was even a year or two ago. I'm excited that, I mean, I think the future, the electrified future is an exciting one. I think there's economic opportunity. So I think that we can make choices as consumers. Again, we have to pay very careful attention, though, that everyone gets to participate in that future economy and the economic opportunity. But I'm excited about wind and solar coming to Minnesota, things like that.
Great answers, you guys. Great perspective. We also have this room full of wonderfully smart, curious, engaging people. So I want to get some questions from the audience, if we can. Sir, looks like you're first. Thank you.
Say your name. I'll hold the mic.
Todd from St. Paul.
Hi, Todd.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you for all this and everybody here. And I might just say that you're my favorite meteorologist.
Thank you for that.
Mainly because of ClimateCast. And that is the question. There's four meteorologists on TV, and I do not hear them once in 365 days talk about climate change, talk about the most important aspect of why we're all here together. How do we change that? I've spoken to three of them, and I've gotten blank stares. Even at the state fair with Belinda Jensen, who you know, she would not even engage in the conversation about how she needs to bring out that on air. She needs to talk about it and encourage the population to think more about that. Thank you.
Thank you. That's a great question. And you know what? I can tell you this. There is a lot of talk right now in my professional organization, the American Meteorological Society, and was at this year's annual meeting about how responsible should AMS members be who are TV weathercasters in talking about climate science. The AMS has a statement on climate change. It's very clear and unequivocal that humans are causing at least part, making a contribution to climate change. And there are many of us in the field who feel like if we're an AMS member, it's our responsibility to talk about climate change and report on that science, just as it is to report on weather science. So there are conversations around that. The obvious fly in the ointment for many ownership groups and TV stations and meteorologists is, why do I want to alienate 30 or 40% of my audience by talking about something that they either don't agree with or don't understand or don't accept? So those are conundrums. It's one, thankfully, I've been lucky. I did TV for 20 years before I worked here at NPR. I've been lucky with my ownership groups that they've allowed me to report on that. I've been reporting on climate science on the air since the late 1990s. But it's a problem. I'm probably one of the more radical members of my profession that thinks that if you have an AMS seal, you should be required to report on climate science. You don't just get to pick part of the science that you report on.
Paul,
Paul, I've got a question from Twitter.
Okay, thanks, Elizabeth.
From Cody. Actually, I'm just going to have Cody read it.
So this is from Timothy Edward Nixon. Are you here, Tim? Timothy? There we are. Some climate-denying politicians say change is happening and humans are partially responsible. So what is problematic with this new spin and how to respond?
Tim Nixon with Thomson Reuters.
Let me try to clarify a little bit.
That Twitter thing, you know.
So I think there's this issue of partially responsible, and it's a huge potential sort of range of responsibility, right? And it's creating sort of doubt and fog around, well, what is the human role? Do we really know how much humans should even be sort of taking a role in the solution? And I'm seeing that as sort of a new spin on sort of delaying action. So I wondered how you would sort of respond to that. I've heard it from some of our gubernatorial candidates and also at the EPA today. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think part of this is going to get solved in the courts, because we're seeing more and more climate change lawsuits coming out. We're seeing a case for reparations, climate reparations being made. We're seeing major cities like San Francisco, the Bay Area, suing fossil fuel producers. I think there's always going to be that segment of the U.S. political landscape that is going to, in one way or another, try to push off solutions, try to deny the science, and that's terribly unfortunate. I'm just hopeful that we're reaching a critical mass to the point where we're starting to see the impacts of this more and more. When parts of the southeast U.S. coast, they've now measured 5 inches of sea level rise in the last 5 years, we're seeing these impacts come home to roost. And I guess that's where my hope lies, is that we're going to change enough minds soon enough. And we're not going to change everybody's mind, but there's going to be people who are seeking to be made whole from the changes that we're seeing.
Paul, I was going to add, but you... You want to add too? Good question. Okay, I'll go real quick. I was at 3M yesterday, and I saw the Nobel laureate from 1995, Mario Molina, was in town. And he, one of his slides that he brought up there was the latest IPCC report. And he really described it in probabilities, right? So the way that he told people to think about it is that there's a 95% chance that humans are causing this. So that's the way that he put it. But Jessica can probably do even better than that.
No, that's good. I just, we talked a little bit earlier about the climate community becoming even a little bit more savvy about how to talk about science. It's extraordinarily easy to exploit that uncertainty. Well, there's 5%, you know, 5%, I don't know, maybe. But I think that, and I don't know the specific reference, I don't actually know what the gubernatorial candidates, for example, have said recently, but I think in the way that you're expressing it is to say that that's just downright disingenuous, right? It's not true. It's not accurate. Are there factors that cause climate change that have nothing to do with people? Absolutely. It's called the ice ages, right? But what we are talking about on this time horizon, since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, there is no other factor that can explain the changes in climate that we have observed on this time horizon. Now, if we all have the privilege of living for another 40,000 years or so, then we can talk about the other factors that also influence climate. And there are other interesting climate factors that are important too, like volcanoes that we can study and think about, you know, how we can learn how they influence climate. Maybe there's something useful there. You know, that's another controversial topic. But to say, oh, we don't know, is to on purpose confuse what we do know and what we don't know. And I think as a climate community, we have to call that out. And it's not fun, and it gets a little old, but you have to just say it over and over and over again.
I would also just add that, you know, the people who are here in this room tonight, you care about the future of your community. You care about the future of America. Why else would you come at 7:30 at night to talk about climate change, right? So I just also think it's really important for all of us to stay focused and disciplined on the solutions, because we could waste a lot of our time around constantly trying to respond to the climate deniers. And what I would say is you don't need to call it climate change, but, you know, if it, poor people in Miami live in a place where they, it is a sunny day and their neighborhoods are flooding, like, let's talk about that. I don't care what you call it. Let's talk about the fact that one in 30 wells have run dry in the western states. Let's talk about what we're going to do to make sure that people have safe, clean access to water. And so I say we have to have discipline as those who are stewards for our communities and for this country to focus on the solutions.
Yeah, I feel like the train's leaving, and we don't need everybody to get on, yeah. And some people yeah. won't get on. Yeah. But we're still going.
Go.
Sir.
So,
Ron, can you say your name?
Ron Albrecht from West St. Paul. So my question to you is, what can all of us go home and try to do to make this a better planet?
I like Mark's idea. Talk mm-hmm. to your friends, your family, your neighbors. One of the walk the talk things that I've done in my life is I opted to go 100% wind for my home electricity. That's an option you can do. That's something you can do tomorrow. You know, there are if people are in a position to do that, obviously you can change the transportation that you're using to a more climate-friendly vehicle. Transportation and electricity are the two biggest CO2 emitters. So those are the two places you can make the biggest impact. And I also like the notion of talking to your city. The more people hear demand on climate action, the more response we're going to get.
I would say vote. I mean, we have a major election cycle coming up. And hold your policymakers accountable.
Many communities are going through they either, as our young people have already alluded to, they've either already gone through the process of a climate action plan, or they're in the midst of it, or they're contemplating doing so. And that's a community level of engagement that everybody can get engaged in. And besides the role modeling, I'd like to throw one maybe broader perspective into this. And I think with the threat that we've seen in the last year or more emerge in our own American landscape that shows great disrespect for science in general, not just climate science, science in general, we need to be very sensitive to that. And I think we need to teach our children and those we associate with that the reason we've evolved to the way we've evolved is because of a huge knowledge base that's been generated by science, and we can't leave that behind. We've got to have respect for what science can do for us across the board, not just climate science.
Let's see if we got time for a couple more questions here from the audience.
All right, say your name, please.
Okay, hi, Rocky DiGiacomo. Not so much a question as a comment. Someone down here in the front row asked a question that I've heard asked at any number of these forums: what can I do? And the panel often reacts, as I heard this panel react, gee, I'm not sure. And I'm quite certain we can all act as individuals because we're lucky enough to live in the state of Minnesota where buyback is required by the electric utilities. Now, what that means is that if you put solar panels on your home, then you don't have to have another $25,000 worth of batteries in your basement. All you got to do is have the panels. And that means whether you're using the electrons or the surrounding homes in your neighborhood are using those electrons, the generation is being used 100% of the time. That turns the electric utilities into a system, not so much as generators. It means all of us can become micro producers. And the paybacks on that work. They're not great, but they work, and the panels are getting cheaper thanks to China. So the paybacks are only getting better. And if you don't have good south-facing roof lines, or you don't want the ugly things on your roof to advertise to your neighbors that you care about this, then you can sign up for, again, if you're in the Xcel Energy range with your home, you can sign up for their program called WindSource. And that doesn't mean that you necessarily get electrons directly from windmills. And it actually doesn't even refer to windmills. It refers to renewable energy generally that Xcel Energy produces. And they're required to produce a certain amount by state mandate. But if you sign up for WindSource and you can go home tonight and you can click a few buttons into their website, find WindSource, Google it, it'll take you right there, and you can sign up. And you can sign up in blocks of percents. You can sign up for 10%, 20%, 100%. And the cost of it's pretty minimal.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Those are great. So net metering, this idea that we live in a state where the grid is required by law to take your power that you generate. Also in Minnesota, we live in a state that has some pretty favorable community solar legislation. So if you don't live in a situation where you can put solar on your roof, there are favorable policies where you can get together with your friends and neighbors and act collectively, which is actually pretty exciting because it sits in that space between what do you know, your individual responsibility and how we act collectively. So another thing to do is go home and actually start talking with your neighbors about how you want to get together and participate in solar.
Kate, you have another question over here?
Yeah.
Hi.
My name is Elizabeth Arnold. I have a question about, we talk a lot about contribute to actions against climate change, installing things in your home. But that costs money, and I was wondering if you guys have any viable solutions for people who can't afford that or, don't want to make major infrastructure changes in their personal homes, like maybe waste reduction or something like that.
Jessica?
Well, so a number of things about that. Renewable energy, say solar, for example, even in Minnesota, as we just heard, can be very cost-effective. And in the long run, once you pay for that solar infrastructure, then it's power for free, essentially. I mean, you still have to connect to the grid. But the idea that you need to make an upfront investment, the upfront investment can be quite expensive. And so one of the things that we need are mechanisms by which people can actually acquire the loans. And California actually has a lot of really creative programs by which you can rent to own and, sell. You can lease your roof to others to use and this kind of thing. And there's a lot of creative things that we can do in Minnesota to make the upfront cost of solar more cost effective. That's one idea. The fact that renewable power is sort of long-term cheap power, if you can afford the upfront costs, actually means that in public infrastructure, it can be a particularly good investment. So if you think about things that taxpayers are paying for, you would look more favorably on renewable power because it reduces the operating costs of public infrastructure. So that's pretty appealing. And then not to mention, mostly because of wind, if you build utility-scale wind power like we do here in Minnesota, it's becoming cheaper than not only building new coal plants, but it's actually becoming cheaper than operating the existing coal plants.
And it's creating a lot of jobs, too, in the process. That's something we haven't talked a lot about tonight, but a very positive trend that's happening. Kate?
I'm Jason from St. Louis Park, and my question was, what do you think it'll take to make our political leaders take real action?
Do you want to say?
That's a young man without a lot of patience. I kind of like that. Here's my two cents, and Radhika touched on it. I think it's going to take some wave elections, and where climate is one of the major drivers. I think it's that simple.
Yeah, there's something about, a young person standing up and asking that question and expecting it to be answered by a politician is a great start. I think we have to have ways in our political system of addressing these longer-term challenges, too. There's just a lot of kick the can, I'm worried about my next reelection campaign, and I don't see what I'm going to get out of really tackling and addressing this problem. So there's not only just the political differences between parties, but an expectation that we want our politicians to be doing long-term planning and building these resilient systems that will help us be prosperous in the future.
And yet Minnesota's been pretty successful with this politically, right? I mean, we've instituted these renewable energy standards. It's happened faster than a lot of people thought it might. Mark, Radhika, what do you think? Can that translate to the rest of the country and nationally?
I don't know. I am encouraged by the I think there's a big disparity across the generations here, so I am encouraged by the younger people and that the electorate that is composed of that group will have a much more powerful voice in the next two election cycles. So I do expect to see, I hope it's not a false expectation, but I do expect to see some of the other states change over in this regard.
Okay.
In the next two cycles.
Well, I hope you're right, and I hope we can see this trend keep moving forward. You know, I want to thank all of you tonight. This has been a really eye-opening thing for me, and I love hearing perspective from different people who are working in different areas of climate. It's always illuminating to me, and I hope to our audience, too. Could you guys please thank Jessica Hellman, Radhika Fox, and Mark Seeley? Thank you. A couple of thoughts before we adjourn this evening. You know, I was thinking about how much progress we have made in the last 5 years. Public acceptance of humans' role in climate change has gone up considerably. The needle is moving. Gallup polls have gone from about 57 to 68% in the past decade. And a lot of the discussion really is what we're seeing tonight. It's gone from, hey, are we causing this, to what are we going to do about it? And what are we going to do about it is the ground truth is happening. Renewable energy has boomed in the past 5 to 10 years. 4 states now, Iowa, South Dakota, Kansas, and Oklahoma, all generate more than 30% of their annual electricity from wind power. The U.S. Department of Energy reports 3 million Americans now work directly in the clean energy industry. That's if you include energy efficiency, smart grid, energy storage, renewables, and electric and hybrid vehicles. We talked about Fortune 500 companies increasingly making climate sustainability part of their business model. So I feel like we are making progress globally and locally, and even a little bit here on our work with ClimateCast. I've interviewed many of the world's top scientists in the last 5 years, climate scientists, and we're going to continue to focus on the latest climate science, this growing science of extreme weather attribution. Try to make this real for people on how climate is hitting us all at home. And of course, we're going to be focused on solutions as well. We're focused on the economic opportunities that climate change offers. There's a lot of climate cliches and quotes floating around out there, but this one sticks with me. And it's hard to pin some of these down. It appears to have come from a Shell Oil researcher in a piece in The Economist in 1999. And the quote is, "The Stone Age did not end because the world ran out of stones. And the oil age will not end because we run out of oil." So in other words, we found a better way to do things in the Stone Age. And now the technology is here and has given us better ways to produce energy. I see this as much as a technological evolution as anything else. And, you know, we used to burn coal in our homes 100 years ago. Now it's big, huge power plants. Now we're transitioning to wind and solar. So we're going to find better ways to do this. They're already here. And we can create jobs, grow our economy, and save our climate all at the same time. To me, that kind of sounds like a win-win-win. Thanks to all of you and our amazing guests tonight, and thanks to all of you for coming out to ClimateCast Live. Good night, everybody.